There was an upswing in violence this past weekend that threatens to derail the tentative peace established recently by Israeli and Palestinian leaders and to unravel a five-month-old ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Bahoum renewed calls today for Palestinians to step up violence against Israel, while Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert defended the killing of nine Palestinians in violent clashes this past weekend. In a new book, Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, Sari Nusseibeh, president of Al-Quds University, offers his thoughts on how to effect a peaceful solution to this seemingly never-ending conflict. It's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and I'm very pleased it brings Sari Nusseibeh to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
And I should mention the book is co-authored by Anthony David. Isn't your training as a scholar of Islamic philosophy? How did you get into politics? Because of your father?
No, I went back to teach in 1978 when I finished my PhD. I'd finished my education both in England and then later in the States. And I went back, started teaching at Birzeit University on the West Bank with my wife, Lucy. And very quickly, as soon as I started teaching, becoming a professor, I became entangled in the political situation. It sort of happens to everyone there.
Well, the title actually comes from your attempts to convince Lucy that it would be okay to go to the Middle East. You started telling a story that started off with Once Upon a Country?
Well, Lucy's sort of always been actually attracted by the country and the history, and she'd visited once before, and to go back to the politics of it, the fact that we went back, the fact that we started teaching, I think just made us become entangled in the political life, even against our better judgment.
Well, your father was a high-ranking Jordanian politician when you were growing up. Was that a reason not to get into politics?
Oh, absolutely.
Watching him?
Oh, absolutely. If you grew up with a politician for a father, you'd probably have grown up to be that set against becoming involved in politics.
That's why you've been called a reluctant politician. But
That's one reason. Maybe there are other reasons as well.
Well, your father also lost one of his legs.
It was in the fighting, the 47-48 fighting. He was shot in the leg, and it had to be amputated. And he became involved. He was involved, again, against his better judgment in politics, because he was really a lawyer. He was trained as a lawyer. And then became involved in the war of 47-48, and then later in the government of all Palestine, the Palestinian government, and later in the Jordanian political life.
It's often said that people in the West don't really understand Islam, or they misinterpret things. But isn't that partly because there are just so many different interpretations of Islam within the Muslim world?
Well, I mean, I think that can be said about almost anybody not understanding their religion or somebody else's religion. I don't think that it's necessarily true that Muslims understand necessarily Islam in the same way as each other.
But, for example, in other religions, many religions, not all religions, there seems to be some kind of agreed to set of interpretations. In some cases, there are even hierarchical situations, as there are in Catholicism, as there are in Shia. But in the Sunni world, it seems that almost every imam can come up with a different reading of the Quran. And so we get people who say, no, the Islam is this very peaceful religion. No, Islam is a jihadist religion, and on and on and on. And it's a matter of who you want to believe.
Well, let me first say, preface what I'm going to say by saying I'm not really an expert on the subject. But, the thing, as I understand it, about Islam, the way that I was brought up, is that everybody is equal before God, that everybody has direct access to God, and that there's no, as you said, no hierarchy, there's no set definition of what you're supposed to believe, except your own understanding. And, of course, one follows also the teachings, the interpretations of people that are schooled in exegesis, in the interpretation of the Quran. And but there is no set or defined framework that everybody has to believe. So it's not certainly not like Catholicism.
I mentioned that you were trained as a scholar of Islamic philosophy. Has your knowledge of medieval thought given you insight into modern events?
Well, first of all, you know, my PhD was on a philosopher who lived in the Islamic period, and he was a Neoplatonist. And you know, if you'd read him in Greek, you wouldn't have known that he was writing necessarily in the context of the Islamic milieu. What we call Islamic philosophy, what we call even medieval philosophy at the time, really was a continuation of the Greek heritage. And it flows into contemporary philosophy, so that there's no real distinction. There aren't any defining marks between, say, Jewish medieval or early Greek or medieval Muslim or Christian philosophy. But I would say that certainly studying philosophy, of any age, is something that's very useful for dealing with life, with the contemporary world, and for dealing with politics.
My guest is Sari Nusseibeh. His book, Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Leon Wieseltier wrote a review of your book in the New York Times Book Review, and it created something of a firestorm. You would have thought that you were a radical based on what has been said. How did you react to that review?
Well, I thought it was a... what do you expect me to have... How do you expect me to have reacted? I thought it was a good review. It was very well written. There were certain elements in it that I, didn't necessarily agree with.
Well, one person wrote, this is like asking a meat eater to review a vegetarian cookbook. But he does seem to be sympathetic. He starts out with, how does one regard a good man in a dark time? With joy, obviously, but also with sorrow. Seneca said in one of his letters that you must either hate the world or imitate it, but there are a few things in the world so stirring as a man who neither hates it nor imitates it, but in the name of what is best in it, resist what is worst in it. Do you see yourself in that?
Well, I understand what he said, and probably everybody can understand what he said. And I think if I interpret what he said correctly, what I understand him to be saying there is that looking at the Middle East, there aren't really very many signs on a rational basis to be optimistic. You just quoted the violence that's taking place back home. That seems to just come back again and again. And if one's using one's reason and does not seem to see any signs for a positive development, one cannot but feel depressed. And so it's good if every now and again there are signs of hope and optimism.
The lines seem to be drawn so hard, so harshly, and there doesn't seem to be much room for compromise in that world, even though to outsiders there seems to be plenty of space for compromise.
Well, like I say in the book, I think that looks can be deceptive. Things can look like there's no chance for reconciliation. But I've lived long enough in that area, and I've experienced enough of politics in that area to know that what might look at one minute like an impossible task can the next morning become a normal daily routine, such as, for example, reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. There were times when you would never have thought it was possible, and then suddenly times when you saw that Israelis and Palestinians were actually heading towards peace.
Well, there are these documentaries that keep on being shown. I just received one the other day in which women are trying to lose weight, Palestinian Jewish women, and they somehow use their attempts to lose weight as also a way of making other kinds of connections. But then I read in the paper about violence on both sides and intransigence, it seems to me that this is a situation that would be very hard to overcome. You were involved with the Oslo Accords, weren't you?
Well, not specifically. I was involved in the negotiations that preceded Oslo, and I was involved in the negotiations right up to the signing of Oslo.
And many people said afterward that they were impossible to implement, that it was nice that some people signed it, a pact.
You have to take a historical look on what's happening. And, you know, by all accounts, if you looked at the late 80s and early 90s, many people would have said even then that peace was totally an impossible dream. But nonetheless, the Israelis and the Palestinians got together and signed an agreement, the Oslo Agreement. Now, it didn't work out, but it was a sea change. There was a major transformation there, and I think that one should look at it positively. And, you know, although, of course, there's a lot of violence, and violence rules the day, you must not forget that essentially Palestinians and Israelis are ordinary people, ordinary human beings. They're not political leaders, necessarily. The people that are in politics are not the majority, they're the minority on both sides. And as ordinary human beings, Israelis and Palestinians really want peace, like everybody else.
On the other hand, in both countries, the people elected to office tended to be hardliners.
Well, I think the people that are elected to office very often think that they're elected because they're hardliners.
But well, Ariel Sharon and then Hamas, they both represented the hardline positions
On the Palestinian side, you know, many would say that the election of Hamas was a reaction, really, and that deep down, and still if you go by the polls, you'll find that most Palestinians are in favor of a two-state solution, of peace with Israel. They don't think that the Israelis are up to the challenge. They don't think that the Israelis want peace. And then again, if you go to Israel, and in spite of the fact that they've elected Sharon or the right-wing government, and look at the polls, you'll find that, again, a majority of the Israelis are in favor of a peace that's acceptable to the Palestinians, a two-state solution. But they don't believe that the Palestinians are themselves ready. So here you have a curious situation where the two sides think that the other side is not ready, but they're themselves ready. So what you need really is a leadership that can read that.
Well, you've criticized the Arafat government and the Fatah government, that the PLO government that preceded, for the kind of corruption that was endemic there. Today, I read in the newspaper that I think the Israeli Minister of Finance has just been forced to step down because he was accused of embezzling before he went to office. But you get the feeling that both sides say, well, the other side really can't do this. This is a matter of will.
Well, look, as far as the political leaderships are concerned on both sides, clearly there are many drawbacks, there are many difficulties. And as you just pointed out, there's a lot of corruption on both sides. And but you were talking about just the leaderships. And when you look at the wider spectrum of the people on both sides, what you see are peoples on both sides, very ordinary human beings, whose interest is neither in making money or in overcoming the other side, but in living proper lives. And
Can't that translate into something that leadership can pull off?
Well, that's a good question. I think if I could answer it, we wouldn't be having this interview today.
One reviewer said that if you and Shimon Peres were locked in a room, you could solve the problem.
Well, I'm not sure about Shimon Peres, but there are certainly Israelis with whom I can probably, with whom, in fact, I have signed documents. There's a specific person today on the Israeli side fighting for leadership in the Labour Party by the name of Ami Ayalon, with whom I've, in fact, signed a six-principle document. And if he's leader of the Israeli, on the Israeli side, I think he'd certainly quickly reach peace with the Palestinians.
You speak Hebrew.
A little bit, yes.
Although I remember speaking to David Grossman about his friends. He has friends who are Palestinians who speak Hebrew. He speaks Arabic. He said when they get together, they talk in English so that neither side has an advantage.
Well, there's some, of course, Palestinians, some Arabs who speak Hebrew very well, who write Hebrew very well. In my case, for instance, I don't speak Hebrew at all very well in the first place. But
you
would
speak English very well.
But I would choose not to speak Hebrew very often in situations with Israelis in which there's confrontations. Like if I'm, you know, stopped by a soldier who speaks Hebrew to me, I will certainly answer in either Arabic or English. But that's a confrontation kind of situation. People like David Grossman I'd speak English with because I think I feel comfortable speaking to him in English. He feels comfortable speaking to me in English. And I read his books in English, too.
Sari Nusseibeh's book, Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, written with the help of Anthony David, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sari Nusseibeh. His book, Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You've said that one of your intellectual heroes is Thomas Jefferson. I'm quoting, "What was so astounding for me about Jefferson, in contrast to Robespierre, say, or any of the Arab revolutionary leaders, was the systematic manner in which he went about putting flesh and bones on the conception of liberty by building free institutions." But would a Jefferson even be possible in the Middle East? He was a deist. Can a religious government offer the same liberties that a secular one can?
Well, the couple of things that very impressive that impressed me that were very impressive about him. One was the fact that he participated in the formulation of independence, of a declaration of independence, and looked upon himself as somebody who wished to formulate this on behalf of the American people, regardless of his religious beliefs, regardless of his personal life, because one knows that maybe there were some inconsistencies.
As a slave owner.
As a slave owner and whatnot. But, you know, you have to take into account the difference in time and the context. The other thing was the fact that he set out to establish the university. And those two elements somehow, in my own experience, reverberated something very important, because on the one hand, I found myself also involved in the formulation of an independence effort on the part of the Palestinian people, or together with other people. And on the other hand, I found myself also involved in the establishment of a university and guided by the same principles, basically, of liberty, of equality between the people, and of having an open system. I think one can do this regardless what one's background is, regardless what one's religion is. These are human values and universal values that people can agree upon.
Weren't you in charge of the media campaign for the first Intifada to present the Palestinian case?
Well, I wasn't. I wouldn't put it like that. I realize this was how somebody put it somewhere. But, you know, I was involved on behalf of one of the organizations in the PLO at the time, namely Fatah, to formulate the strategy for the uprising at the time. And I basically had sufficient influence at one point to make the strategy of Fatah that of being a nonviolent civil disobedience. Now, the PLO consisted of many factions. You couldn't be influential every minute of the day in every respect, but for as long as Fatah remained at the time the main organization, I think it was primarily therefore led in this direction, namely a civil disobedience campaign, and that is to the extent to which I was involved.
You supported the first Intifada, but not the second one?
That's right. The first, you know, as soon as it erupted, as soon as it was harnessed into a political movement with very clear vision and an end solution, a political settlement between ourselves and the Israelis, you know, to that extent, I found that the uprising was useful, can lead to a political end. With the with what is called the Second Intifada, all I saw was simply an eruption of violence, which was chaos that led nowhere. It was primarily militaristic, violent. There was no leadership. There was no end vision. There was no strategy to lead to that vision. And it has actually, on a daily basis, just made our situation as Palestinians worse. We lost through the last 4 or 5 years of violence, whereas we gained, I think, from the first 2 years of uprising in the first Intifada.
What did you do as the PLO representative in Jerusalem 2001, 2002?
I couldn't do very much. I tried to establish a few parties, you know, have a couple of celebration events, which I was prevented from holding. But as you know, the PLO, the Palestinian also authority, had no legislative or executive powers within Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. So we couldn't. I couldn't really do very much.
And you blame Arafat for many of the problems. You've described his manner of rule as a formula for a Ba'athist-type dictatorship.
Well, I blame Arafat, and I also praise Arafat. I'm not. I don't see things in terms of black and white. There are very many aspects in which I thought Arafat did things properly or did things in a way that I would admire. But then he was a human being. He had a lot of limitations. And some of the limitations had to do especially with the way that he set out to establish the system, the authority, the state. And certainly I also think that the way that he tried to negotiate with Israel, to my mind, did not necessarily reflect the best that could have been done.
Well, when he presided over the struggle, you say that the Palestinians, I'm quoting, were once again falling into that perennial trap. They thought somehow the world would step in like a deus ex machina,
yes,
and set things right.
Because, you know, that's unfortunately an attitude that Palestinians, Arabs, but Palestinians who especially believe that they are right, that they are in the right, constantly believe all the time that somehow or another somebody will step in from the outside and make things right, that justice will somehow be brought about by somebody intervening from the outside, be it the United States or the United Nations. Never was it in people's minds, nor is it today, in fact, believed that you, the people, can make the difference, not somebody from outside.
You say that Arafat blew it by not closing some sort of deal at Camp David. Was that totally his fault?
And no, no, and it wasn't only his fault. It was the fault, I think, of everyone that was at Camp David in different ways. I think that the three sides, in fact, made mistakes in different ways. Arafat made a mistake in his own way. And in my opinion, the mistake that he made was to allow the talks to break up the way they did. And regardless of whether it was somebody else's fault or regardless of to what extent the other side was being intransigent, nonetheless, it is my opinion, it was then, it is now, that the Palestinians should not should try their best not to allow such talks to break up.
Well, if I were Arafat, I have to be honest, I would have looked at what happened to Anwar Sadat and thought, well, gee, if I come to some kind of an accommodation with the Israelis, there's a good chance I'm going to die.
Well, you know,
and assassinations have occurred on both sides as a result of a peace initiative.
I don't think Arafat was worried about that. You know, he didn't think that death was something that was terrifying necessarily, or that being assassinated is something to make you not do or do something that you otherwise wouldn't choose to do. But I think that at Camp David, he thought that he couldn't get the deal that he wanted to get. And he decided this was, you know, a be-all, end-all kind of situation. And that is, I think, what was wrong. I think he wanted peace, by the way. I think he was committed, really wanted to make peace with Israel. And he did, actually, much more than anybody else did on the Palestinian side in this direction. But the failure was that we couldn't take the last step. And, you know, the last step is still there to be taken. So the advances that were made in the past, I think, could still be made use of, and we could still achieve peace.
Didn't you think that 9/11 presented an opportunity for the Palestinians to make peace with Israel?
Well, the opportunity is always there, I think, to make peace, in the sense that, you know, it is always necessary. It is in the interest of the two sides. By the way, it's important also always to remember that as you ask those questions, that while on the one hand the Palestinians, of course, are in need of peace and may seem to be more in need of peace than the Israelis, on the other hand, in fact, the Israelis are also in need of peace. And this is a situation in which just as, you know, much, much, you know, differently than how wars are waged, peace needs the two sides together. If you have a situation of war, one country, one side, can decide to wage war on another side, on another party, without having to have the other party agree to waging that war. But peace is totally different. You can only wage it or create it together with the other party. And so whenever there's a failure of achieving peace in the Middle East, I think one should always look at the two sides. and try to learn what the problems are on both sides.
And I gather that's what happened when you learned Hebrew in 1968 and worked on a kibbutz. You said that just as I had suspected since listening to the Beatles over enemy radio waves, the Israelis were normal people just like us. But you also spent 3 months in an Israeli prison at one point. What led to that?
Well, you'd have to ask the Israeli security experts or officials, but at the time I was taken under an order signed by the Minister of Defense called an administrative detention order. This is a leftover from the British mandatory times, and it's a way by which Israeli authorities can put you in jail without taking you to trial. So they can take you and put you under administrative detention for 3 months, for 6 months. Actually, the order in my case was for 6 months.
And they charge you with anything?
No, because it's not a thing that, you know, for which you can be charged. But at the time, what they did was to send out the rumor that I was actually involved in the Iraqi, that I was the master spy of an Iraqi spy ring. And, Bibi Netanyahu said this officially and so on. But it was total rubbish. And, 3 months down the line, they had to let me go. But I think at the time, the people who put me in jail took me to jail for something totally different, which was my involvement in the Intifada, in the First Intifada. And they couldn't take me to trial, for my involvement in the First Intifada, because I don't think it would have looked good for them.
So it's better to say that you were working for Saddam Hussein.
So it's much better to say that, even if it's only for 3 or 6 months that I'm put away.
But some readers have taken issue with your comparisons of Israeli prisons to the Gulag.
Well, perhaps it's an exaggeration, absolutely. I mean, you know, among them, the review that you mentioned right at the very beginning, and it's quite true. But look, on the other hand, I think the point that was made there is that although, of course, Israel for Israelis is a democracy, if you look at the way that Israel has treated the Palestinians, and especially the Palestinians, let us say, under occupation from 67 onwards, and you look at the cases of imprisonment that have taken place, and I'll remind you that we probably have more than 500,000 cases of imprisonment in a population of only about 3 or 4 million people. That's an enormous number. And very often the cases of imprisonment are cases of administrative detentions, like the one that I went through. You don't really find the kind of justice that you normally find in normal courts.
Jimmy Carter got into a lot of hot water when he used the word apartheid to describe the situation. Would you use a word like that?
I don't think it's necessary to tell the world what a terrible situation the occupation is, to use terms describing situations from other experiences. The South African situation was an unacceptable situation. The situation in Palestine is unacceptable. But I think, you know, if I were to describe it, I'd describe it differently. I mean, the wall, for instance, that's being built physically separates between people. In South Africa, this wasn't the case, but this is just one example.
Now, you've also been criticized for your account of the war in 48-49. You say it was never a fair fight, nor could it have been. Well, why wasn't it a fair fight? Israel enjoyed no military superiority going into the war, and the Arabs of Palestine were joined by the armies of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, augmented with troops from Sudan, in fact, the current leader of Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Morocco.
Well, come on. I mean, if you add up, just add up like that, you may think that, you have a lot of Arab armies over there, but actually it's just names. In fact, you never had a proper Arab army, certainly not a ready army, certainly not a committed army. And within Palestine itself, we didn't have a proper defense mechanism. And, you know, you can see that from the memoirs even that my father had written at the time of what was happening.
Many people say that the real stumbling block is the whole matter of the right of return. How can that be resolved?
Well, It's another point for which I've come under a lot of criticism. But basically, what I think is possible is the following, that if we establish a two-state solution, two states alongside each other, then the right of return of the Palestinians who live abroad can be practiced and implemented within the context of the Palestinian, of the future Palestinian state. There has to be compensation, and there has to be also, in my opinion, a recognition by the Israeli side of the pain that was caused to the Palestinians. But the Palestinians have to recognize on their hand, on their part, that it's impossible, in fact, to implement the right of return in the way that they have so far wished or dreamed. But in order to do this, in order to reach an agreement on the right of return, we have to reach an agreement on some on all the other issues, and primarily, in my opinion, the issue of Jerusalem is foremost, East Jerusalem to be the capital of a future Palestinian state.
Another major stumbling block. But despite the fact that you take those positions, I gather you have to have bodyguards?
Well, for the last two or three years, I've had to, you know, I've talked out against various taboos, you know, like, for instance, the question of the right of return. I've spoken in ways that are not used to, people are not used to them. I've spoken out against suicide attacks. I've actually spoken out against even the use of any kind of violence. I've called for the establishment of a non-militarized Palestinian state. And clearly, you know, I've come under a lot of criticism, and I value my safety. And I was attacked physically about 20 years ago
by
for
students.
Doing something by students. Sorry.
Well, do people see your look at your background in Oxford and Harvard say he's just become too westernized?
Well, they look at me and they say he seems peculiar, but this does not diminish from their admiration and love and respect in many instances. And the fact that I have bodyguards to defend myself against a few doesn't mean that the many who actually interact with me do not show me their love and respect.
Well, we can only hope that we will achieve peace in the Middle East. I can't imagine this going on forever, although it feels like it may very well.
Well, if I may, just one last word to say here is, you know, it's not a question of hope, it's a question of faith. We have to actually work to make it happen.
Sari Nusabe will be speaking with Ethan Bronner tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. You can find a link to that on our show page at wnyc.org if you want to get tickets. The book, Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, is published by Farah Strauss and Giroux. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great pleasure.
It's been a great honor for me to be with you.
On tomorrow's show, we talk to a French journalist who was imprisoned and tortured by French paratroopers in 1957 during the Battle of Algiers. Then the dramatic story of the man who Washington appointed to design the nation's capital in 1791. We survey some of Granta's best young American novelists, plus how the rules of infidelity vary around the world. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Scott Goldberg, Brad Ludlow, and Angie Sheldon. Alex Goldmark was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.